Welcome to the Retail Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Darius Wasefi, and today I'm speaking with Stephanie Botello, founder and CEO of Fitzroy.
Before we start, I want to tell you about Visional Commerce. Visional is the first fully integrated live video commerce platform for online to offline sales of products that need guidance and help to learn and decide. Products like furniture, art, interior design, vintage and antiques, jewelry, watches, and a lot more can benefit immensely from a caring and informed expert when shopping online. Combine that with the power of live video, and the experience is something 99% of consumers love. If you have or run a retail operation, make sure you check out Visional at visional.co. That's visional.co. Now on to our interview.
Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me actually at the shop.org conference in Vegas. What is Fitzroy?
So Fitzroy is an online wholesale marketplace. What we do is essentially we connect independent on both sides for the toy industry and the children's products industry. So on one side of our online marketplace, we have emerging and independent brands. So folks who have everywhere from, you know, someone who has a product idea, they're just getting off the ground, they're raising a Kickstarter, you know, it's like they're really brand new to the industry, all the way to folks who, you know, are not Mattel and Hasbro, right? They're not the 800-pound gorilla in their industry. And so we sort of work on all sizes on that side as long as they are independent. And we help them connect with retailers for their B2B wholesale purchasing. So
okay.
If you are a retailer, you sign on to Fitzroy, and it's an easy way to do all of your buying online across multiple lines, really in one place.
Okay, and how did you come up with this idea?
So I am newer to the retail industry. My background is actually in finance and technology. So started right out of school, was in investment banking. You know, from there, spent some time at a startup. Like, my investment banking focus had been tech. I loved it. I wanted to actually get my hands dirty, become an operator. So did that, moved back over to investing. And when I was in business school, I was at Harvard for business school. And there I spent some time kind of thinking about, you know, what do I really want to do after school? And, you know, was able to really leverage the resources on campus to kind of kick around some ideas. I immediately knew I wanted to do something in the toy space, both because honestly, what could be more fun? But I will say my very first entrepreneurial endeavor way back when was as a kid, I would go to my local craft store, you know, Michael's, and I would buy felt and glitter glue, and I would make finger puppets that I would sell to the other kids in school. So wow. I think I love toys even a little bit more than the average kid. And frankly, like when I was in investing, I didn't really see that much in the space in terms of innovation. So I wanted to spend more time in it. When I was at HBS, I was able to build a recommendation engine for toys. And that was actually consumer facing. So when I graduated, went to, you know, the brands that we were working with and said, like, hey, what do you think about me doing this as a business, as my life, not just a school project? And the feedback that I got was actually really interesting. The feedback was, this would be awesome, can you do it for B2B? And so that's how Fitzroy really started in what it is today in terms of having that B2B focus. And it was largely because those initial users, those initial relationships that I had built, asked to address that pain point.
Okay. So of course, everybody knows about what happened to Toys R Us.
Yeah.
Right. So now on the one hand, this is the biggest toy store and they go out of business. And you're starting a brand new venture in that. So how does the dynamic work?
Yeah, I mean, I have heard and get that Toys R Us question a lot, ever even since I started the business. So I would say even a couple of years ago, you know, before the official like liquidation and bankruptcy this year. I actually think that it's a great thing for the industry. I like being in an industry that's going through change because I think that change really offers a lot of opportunity for new people to think about things in different ways, you know, to come up with new business models, come up with new distribution opportunities, new versions of a supply chain that otherwise hasn't really been rethought in a while. Toys R Us, I feel, is one of those things where you and I could have an entire separate conversation just on it. I think it's an example of a retailer that really struggled to keep up with the times. And by that, I mean like figuring out their omnichannel distribution strategy and moving from someone who was purely big box and, you know, physical commerce to being able to combine the two. I think in terms of where we sit, you know, we love being in the long tail, right? Like our goal and really our mission at the company is to support different, you know, whether that's a different point of view, a different type of product, a different thought on a traditional vertical. And so for us, you know, when we kind of look at the folks in terms of who they want to distribute to, you know, they're companies that aren't necessarily, their goal isn't to sell to Target, Walmart, Amazon, or what used to be Toys R Us. Their goal is actually to target specialty, you know, to get their product into, and for us, it's like, you know, a couple of thousand retail stores that shop with us, but like those mom and pops, those single door stores, those boutiques who also have a point of view in the community that they're serving.
Right. Now, just from what I know about the Toys R Us situation is that perhaps it wasn't even as much the business, it was the amount of debt that they were saddled with when the private equity firm purchased it.
Sure.
So when you're paying $500 million a month in debt payments, you know, that money has to come from somewhere. So anyway, it's kind of sad to see so many people lose their jobs because of that situation, but I agree things are changing.
Yeah.
And even the business side of the things should also change.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the debt note, you know, they went private at a time when I think it was very popular to go private, you know, and very popular to essentially do an LBO, load up a company with a lot of debt, with the goal that eventually you would either sell or take it public again. And I think especially in the toy market, they faced a lot of headwinds in terms of having an open window to kind of go back to market, you know, especially with Toys R Us was a very Q4 heavy company. And so I think a lot of investors were looking for either, you know, being able to evaluate the business well before holiday or kind of holding until after holiday and having to match that with also, you know, an equity window that's open to kind of get out into the market, I think, and ended up being really tough for them.
Right, right. So how large is the toy market?
So the toy market in the U.S. is about $23 billion.
Okay. And how many actually boutique stores are there?
So in terms of, we really think about it as retail endpoints, because one of the things that's interesting for our model is a lot of the stores that we work with aren't traditional toy stores. So we work with toy stores, we work with gift stores, we work with stationery stores, we work with design stores, we work with museum stores. The list really goes on and on. And so there are about 330,000 of those that are out there in the U.S.
330,000.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So that's a combination that I think it makes sense for somebody that sells other things to also add the toy aspect to their store.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's really where we come in. And it's because especially for folks who don't have a toy only focus, you know, it's hard to, they're not going to bring on a toy focused buyer and merchandiser. They're not going to be able to, you know, go to trade shows to find the latest product. They're not even really going to have the time to kind of set up individual vendor accounts with every brand, right? Like we want to make it easy for someone who wants to open, you know, not just a toy aisle, but really a space for children's products in general to do that. And what we found is that regardless of the type of seller that you are, it's almost a no-brainer to add kids products because,
right,
you know, one, it's a great market to be in terms of the end consumer that you get to work with, but also, you know, you're selling adult things, and so you might as well sell the mini versions of them.
Okay.
Especially since sort of this new parent who's coming of age now, you know, is making a lot of thoughtful decisions around like what types of products do I want in my life, and they want to be able to extend that same decision-making process to the types of products that they're bringing in for their children.
You know, a lot of retail companies these days, they say we're a tech company,
sure,
but we're, you know, in the retail business. How do you see yourself?
I mean, I think we're half and half.
Okay.
You know, I think that it's possible to be both. I think the lines between industries are more blurred now than ever. And I think every company needs to be more than one thing, because ultimately, like if you're a tech company, you're servicing an industry, that industry may be other tech companies, or it could be retail, it could be construction, it could be agriculture, it could be finance, it could be media. So
right.
I don't really see it as one or the other. In terms of, you know, how we think about ourselves at Fitzroy, we're definitely a technology company, because at the end of the day, what powers our buying is tech. You know, there's software there. There are algorithms there. That being said, it's like we always say that we're humans powered by technology and not the other way around. Because I do think that, especially with retail, there's a value to having that human touch, to making sure, you know, especially with a lot of the users that we work with, that they know that we're a team here that cares about them, is invested in their success, you know, that they're not going to be on their own to sort of figure out a new platform, a new way of buying, that they have the help that's out there too with Fitzroy.
Okay. I mean, just for the record, I personally think that's the wrong way of saying it, to say you're a tech company. I think the business is a retail business.
Sure.
Or a toy business.
Yeah.
Technology is just a tool. That's the platform. It's like, you know, saying a retailer is a real estate company just because you have a store.
Yeah.
So really the business is retail. The business is the toy retail.
Yeah, and to clarify, it's like we're not saying that we're not a retail company. Yeah. Like we're obviously here at shop.org.
Like I'm talking about some other companies that are like saying just because you innovate on technology and you're heavy in technology doesn't mean you're a technology company. You're a retailer. That's the business.
So I absolutely agree on. I mean, I think especially if you look at some consumer focused companies that have raised a lot of venture capital, you know, as tech companies, I think we'll have to see how those valuations play out and eventually how they get comped, if they get comped as a tech company or a consumer company.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, at the end of the day, you have to be aware of who your end user is, who your end market is. And that's what I meant by saying, like, you can't really be one thing or the other. I mean, for us, we're excited to be a retail company. You know, it's part of the reason that we like working with NRF. Like it's an organization that I think overall is always thinking about what does it mean for retail, right? In changing times where technology could be affecting it more now than it has been in the past.
So on the technology side,
yeah.
When you started, did you actually have a co-founder?
No.
You're okay.
I'm a solo founder.
So that's something else we'll come back to. So you had to figure out what technology to use,
sure.
How to build it. How did you figure that out?
So I built the first version myself. I actually signed up for a coding class while I was at Harvard and started building.
What did you use?
So the very first version was a PHP site. It was terrible, okay. You know, but it was enough to get out there.
Okay.
You know, and it's like, and from there started learning other languages on top of it. Like when I say I signed up for a coding class, I literally signed up for the equivalent of freshman computer science.
Okay.
Why
did you do that? I mean, was it not possible to find somebody else that would do it for you? Or not that saying, this is actually very unique and it's great.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to go through the
it's 100% possible. I thought that it was important. And I think it's also, I think, part of my leadership style where, you know, I wanted to be able to understand every part of the business that I was building and coming to it, you know, with a background where I had finance experience, strategy experience, operational experience, marketing experience. I knew this was a huge blind spot for me. And so I wanted to learn enough so that I could at least be conversant in it so that I could know what was going on with my own company. I mean, it's something that I'm very lucky to work with people who are far more talented in terms of building the tech now than, you know, I was ever going to be. And I rely on my team heavily for that. But I also think that, you know, by rolling my sleeves up and being willing to kind of figure it out the first time myself, it helped in recruiting. You know, it's like when I kind of think about, you know, who leads my tech team now and our entire tech team, like it really kind of gave us a starting point to not just say like, hey, this is what I want you to build, but this is how I've thought about it. You know, this is the MVP that I've come up with. How would you improve on it? What did I do wrong? And I think really set a tone that it's, you know, for us, at least at the company, we want the best idea to win, not necessarily mine or someone else's. It's like, we want to be able to have a conversation around everything that we're building.
Right. Now, I mean, really huge credit to you for doing that, actually, because not everybody is able to do it even if they want to. And I personally believe that one of the biggest challenges and problems with established retailers, especially here, is that the executive suite are very uninformed about technology. So they are totally dependent on what other people tell them. And I think that's a big problem. It, you know, they could do that even 10 years ago. But now you can't really start a retail company without knowing about the technology. So this is like a really great thing that you did. And so then after you got the first version up, then you started bringing in other people and actually, you know, transforming the site into different things.
Yeah, I mean, I grew the team from there. So it's like my first hires were technical hires.
Okay.
You know, and then from there kind of started building out other functions.
Okay. How big is the team?
So we're about 25.
25, yeah. Okay. And you're based in LA?
Yes, we're based in LA.
Okay, why LA?
So I am incredibly excited about the tech community in LA. I think that a couple things. So, you know, I looked at LA, I looked at San Francisco, I looked at New York. I had spent time actually working in New York and in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't as an adult. I actually grew up in the LA area, but I hadn't as an adult like worked in LA. And I knew that I was looking for a couple things. So like one of the great parts about being in LA and being in retail is, you know, Long Beach, everything ships through Long Beach. And so it gave us a way to be close to a lot of our early users, you know, for companies who even weren't based in LA. They had a warehouse in LA, you know, they were using the port. There was a reason for them to come to LA. And so it was great to also have that face-to-face interaction with people, especially like in our early days. And then also with LA, like it's a growing tech industry there. Like it's one where, you know, I think it originally started and kind of got a rap for, you know, a tech industry that was very celebrity focused. There were a lot of kind of celebrity paired tech companies. Whereas now when you go to LA, you really find people building companies in every type of vertical of technology. And that actually reminded me a lot of almost what New York tech felt like when I was there, you know, a couple of years ago. And so kind of being in that environment where, you know, a lot of things were still new, you know, it's the, obviously the smaller industry in LA compared to entertainment versus San Francisco, where everyone's in tech, everyone does tech, I thought really kind of gave us, you know, a couple advantages in terms of the way that we think about things.
Yeah, I mean, the LA startup industry is actually has grown a lot and is one of the top areas in the country for startups to get started. So you specifically selected LA based on these criteria?
Yeah.
Okay. Another thoughtful decision.
Thank you.
Good job. So now, then the next question, being a woman founder,
sure.
What are your thoughts and experiences on that? Because, you know, we all want to have more diversity. It's easier said than done. And, you know, when you get to actually like, you know, starting a company, talking to, so your tech team is probably, are they all male?
No, they're not all male.
Okay, good. So a lot of new things here. So, you know, you get to a lot of companies and the tech team is all male. And they're building a product, for example, for females. You know, so those are all the things that sometimes people don't pay attention to. And I want to know, like, what was your experience going through and building a company by yourself and navigating through this, you know, getting investors?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that I was by myself. So I was definitely a solo founder. I'm the only founder of the company, but I was very lucky in early days to build an advisory board that was incredibly helpful. And so, you know, worked really from day one with Karen Shalik, who is a toy industry veteran. You know, she's been in the business for 30 plus years in so many different capacities. So, you know, she's created products, she's distributed products, she's worked with larger companies through Sesame Workshop and Fisher-Price with Mattel. Like, she's kind of seen it all. And so, you know, it's like I wasn't alone in it, and by no means did I do it on my own. That being said, I definitely had, you know, some high highs and low lows as a founder, especially with the fundraising process, because there is a bias against solo founders, you know, and I completely understand it, because it's a tough gig, and it's even tougher when, you know, you don't have a co-founder or a co-founding team to kind of go through it with. That being said, I think on the flip side, you know, the top two reasons why companies go under are they either A, run out of money, or B, you know, their founders have a disagreement that can't be resolved. And so as a result, like, things get split up in early days. So for me, I really did lean on my advisory board almost as if they were kind of a co-founder in spirit, you know, to go through things. I was also really lucky to have a couple early angels who, you know, were pretty active in the business from like a mentorship role for me. So that was really great. And then to answer your question in terms of, you know, being a female founder, you know, I think it's something where people know the stats around funding that goes to a woman versus a man, or, you know, a team that's all male versus at least has one female on it. And I think for us, like, it's something that we just try to very consciously, you know, do what we can to change going forward, which is what can we do in the makeup of our own company, whether it's the people who work there, the culture that we have, the values that we have, to make sure that, you know, we're fixing it on our level. And so that's why, you know, the answer to your question is no, we don't have an all male technical team. You know, we don't have an all male sales team. Like, we have both diversity in terms of in every single way, right? So not just gender, but, you know, also racial makeup, also, you know, like economic, like we think about it as how can we get as many diverse voices around the table so that we can have as interesting of a discussion as possible to build the best possible product.
That's great. It's definitely something that I always look forward to. Now, so of all the different things that you did as you were building the company, what would you say was the toughest thing to overcome?
What wasn't the toughest? You know, I think it's something where you have to just enjoy the challenges, because every piece of it is going to be hard. You know, it's like you're creating something from scratch on day one. And so you have to kind of enjoy the fact that every piece is going to be hard. Recruiting is going to be hard. Building is going to be hard. Testing is going to be hard. Getting customers is going to be hard. But what I found is if you're always listening to your users, it makes all of those other pieces easier.
Okay. What about the Amazon threat? Is that a factor for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think anyone building any sort of technology that sells anything online, so anywhere in that intersection between tech and retail, has to keep an eye on Amazon, whether they're consumer-facing, B2B-facing. You know, they're not an immediate threat right now in the sense that they don't do a lot in wholesale. They obviously do sell business-to-business already with, you know, a lot of, like, office supplies, equipment, like, things like that. So it's someone that we keep an eye on. But for us, you know, in terms of how we really differentiate, we try to differentiate based on our user experience, based on, you know, the brands that we work with and kind of the product that we're able to have in the marketplace, and making sure that also we're B2B focused, because there are some quirks on wholesale that are very wholesale specific. And so a lot of the tech that we've built is around those features, versus, you know, when you're selling direct to consumer.
Okay. So now, just to be clear, the way the process of how Fitzroy works is that a retailer goes online, somehow they find Fitzroy, they sign up as a purchaser, right?
Correct.
And then you go through an approval process, and once that's done, can you walk me through that process?
Yeah, so retailer signs up with Fitzroy. We do vet every retailer because we want to make sure that we're working with people who have a physical offline brick and mortar. They're not online only. We also only work with folks who do not resell on Amazon. You know, so we want to make sure that they're going to respect MAP policies, things like that. And so once a retailer is approved, joins Fitzroy, you know, has their login, they sign up and they're able to shop across all of our brands. And so with that, you know, we have a very, I would say, consumer-like design to the experience. So the goal is, instead of kind of getting saddled down with catalogs and Excel and PDFs, like, how do you shop for your wholesale in a way that feels modern and fun and easy, that feels in a lot of ways exactly as if, you know, you and I were to sign up and shop on a J.Crew or a Nordstrom or a Revolve or a Shopbop or something like that. You know, anyone that has sort of multiple lines in one place. But in this case, you know, they're able to buy for their store.
Okay, so they sign up, they log in, and then there is an interface basically where they search for products that they're looking for, just like a shopping experience, right?
Yep, exactly. So they're able to discover in a lot of different ways, right? They're able to discover based on the way that we merchandise. So, you know, we pull together collections depending on time of year, you know, holiday, things like that. They're also able to shop by brand. They're able to shop by value. They're able to shop by age range. They're able to, you know, shop by part of the country. They can really narrow down on exactly whatever they feel is going to fit their store.
Okay. And then, so once they do that, they put an order, and you fulfill the order, right? You actually get the product, you deliver it to them.
So it's delivered from the brand. So the brand actually ships directly to the retailer.
Okay, so you don't take possession of the inventory. You don't have to.
No, we do not.
Okay, that's good. That's another headache. So now, what about the marketplace model? You know, marketplaces, of course, can be very, very successful, but they are a double-edged process, right? So you have to find the products and then find the people actually come to the marketplace. Was that difficult for you to be able to, like, make sure that when somebody comes in, you have enough products that they won't go away?
Yes. Well, I think you're alluding to the chicken and egg problem with marketplaces, which every marketplace has. Right. And it, you know, it's...
I'm vegan, so I don't use
it. Right. It's a different metaphor for it. So, you know, I think for us, we started on the brand side, you know, and then in our early days, we focused on the retail side, and then you kind of move back to the brand side, because you, at the end of the day, you want each side of the marketplace to be growing at the same pace as well. So it almost kind of feels like you're on stage spinning plates, and you want to spin one, run all the way to the other side of the stage, spin the other, and then get back to the first side of the stage you were on to spin it before it stops. And so, you know, in early days, it was a lot jerkier in terms of kind of getting the sides of the marketplace to grow. And now, you know, we still kind of go back to that North Star of listening to our user. And so we're always taking recommendations from our retailers for types of product that they want to see, types of brands that they want to work with, you know, to make sure that we have what they're looking for when they're shopping, and vice versa. It's like we always, if brands have retailer recommendations of people they'd specifically like to see on the platform, we take those as well. And I think a lot of that kind of leads into how we've grown as a business. You know, we started in toys, and the piece of feedback that we got was, this is great. We love buying our toys through you guys. What else can we buy through you guys? So, you know, it's like we started expanding into other verticals related to children's. And so now, you know, we went from being toy only to, you know, largely baby and kids to now we work with home and gear as well.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, we do wellness, we do kitchen and entertaining, we do decor, we do mealtime, we do sleep time, we do feeding. So everything that you would really want for, you know, a little one in your life.
That's pretty impressive. So, and the name that you've selected allows you to expand.
It does. Beyond. Yeah.
So it's not like only toy related.
Correct.
So, yeah. Now, talking about products, not the physical products, but actually on the digital site, in the way that the site works and everything, I think, so that's probably one of your roles is deciding what to build and what not to build, right?
Right. How do you make our feature.
Yeah. How do you decide on what not to do?
So I think for us, it's a couple different ways. You know, we obviously have a roadmap that we work on and that we also reprioritize. Like, it's never necessarily set in stone. There's always a lot of trade-offs, you know, both in terms of if you're building one thing, it often means you can't necessarily build something else. We try to release certain features, I would say, in like an MVP way, almost kind of taking that original mentality that I had with the overall business idea, where it's like, how do we do this in a way that is the most cost efficient, is the fastest, get it out there to test, and then we can refine it. So, you know, we even do that on a feature by feature basis versus just sort of applying it to, you know, the overall company. So that way we know we're building in the right direction.
Okay, so you have like an A/B system where you introduce the feature to a certain percentage of users and then measure and see how it works?
We do. We have a group of users that I would say have been early supporters and have really, you know, gotten very involved in terms of voicing, you know, the direction that they'd like us to go in. And that's everything from even starting with feature ideas, right? Like, some of our best feature ideas come from feature requests that come from our users. And so everything from kind of that initial genesis of an idea all the way through, like, okay, you suggested this, we built it, we'd love for you to test it before we release it to our wider community.
Okay. And are you personally like involved in these kind of decisions every day now, or?
Yeah, I still do think about product every day. You know, who we are, our online store essentially, is our features, right? Right. That's what it's made up of. And so I am always thinking about how do we improve that? You know, is it just around curation? Is it around search? Is it around how we display the right products to the right people at the right time? You know, is it around, and as a result, around filtering? You know, I'm always thinking about that. So definitely still very involved.
Okay. But you do have a product lead?
Yes.
Other than yourself?
Yes, I do.
You do? Okay. And then, so you have to come up with a system of balancing opinions and things. And do you rely heavily on data for that?
We do. We rely heavily on data. And then, you know, our overall roadmap, you know, sits with product and sits with design, but we also get feedback across different teams, right? It's like we have to get feedback from our tech team, we have to get feedback from sales, we have to get feedback from customer support. So I would say that for us, our roadmap is more of a living document. And then we basically take a different direction with it, like as we kind of get everyone's opinions.
Right.
But yes, I mean, at the end of the day, like, product's going to sit with product.
Yeah, I mean, roadmaps are almost like becoming like books. By the time you write a book, it's outdated.
Right.
You know, I mean, not that it's bad, it's just outdated. Things are moving so fast. Roadmap also has to be the same. And, you know, having a roadmap that's 3 months even ahead, it's too slow.
So yeah, I mean, I think it's a balance. It's like you have to make sure that, you know, you're getting what you need to out in the short term for whatever sprint you're working on. But at the same time, for, you know, obviously larger decisions, like when we decided to expand beyond toys, you know, there's an entire set of features that have to go with that, right? And that really kind of affect the company as a whole, not just in product. And so it's like those longer term decisions, you know, have to happen months in advance. So it's a balance between making sure that you're getting, you know, smaller things out there that you're always shipping, and then also making sure that whatever you're building is going to be in line with the larger direction you want to take.
So what's the future? What's your goal for the next 12 months, let's say?
So for us, we're really focused on kind of building up our new verticals, you know, in the additional spaces that we've gone into, and continuing to make sure that we have the product that our retailers are looking for.
Are you going to be the next Amazon?
I don't know if we're going to be the next Amazon.
Why
you know,
not?
We'd love to be the next Alibaba.
But
we'll see. But yeah,
I think
so
Jack
like,
Ma is stepping off.
I hear there's an opening.
Yeah, he's looking for a new opportunity.
I think for us,
challenge.
You know, it's like we're definitely looking into other verticals and like what would be a good fit, especially for the retailer base that we've built up. You know, we're also looking into. At the end of the day, we work with small business, right? Like we work with small business on both sides. And so we also are trying to be very thoughtful about what other pain points can we help solve around small business. You know, the first one that we looked at was around discovery. And that's how we started with the marketplace. But we've gotten a lot of feedback on both sides of other difficulties that people have as they're starting their businesses, as they're running their businesses. And we want to help address them as well. You know, we're looking in kind of the fintech payment space to see what we can build there to help there. You know, as people kind of think about their working capital cycles and their cash management, you know, we're looking into even something as far reaching as, you know, if you're a brand and you're looking to expand into specialty and you have to rethink your packaging design and your product line, it's like, are there tools that we can help offer, you know, on our end to across all of our users, it would be helpful. You know, in terms of retail, it's like we think about, you know, how else can we on the retail side service their needs, right? Like, is there competing against Amazon? Is there competing against Target and Walmart? Like, what else can we really help build and kind of be that best-in-class technology provider that they otherwise wouldn't have because they don't have the resources to hire a full product team, hire a full design team, hire a full dev team?
So really, so I'm trying to like pin you on some kind of a label. So here's what I'm thinking is the operating system of a retail store. You're building the operating system. So a retailer can come to Fitzroy and you can take care of a whole set of things.
Yes, we're looking to be full stack in that sense. Yeah.
So interesting. All right. So now what are the, and I'm sure you're always hiring.
Always hiring.
Okay. So what are your top maybe one or two roles that you're trying to fill right now?
So I would say instead of roles that we're trying to fill, I think there's qualities that we're looking for.
Okay.
So curiosity is one of them. I would say that like everyone on our team is incredibly curious, not just about their own job, but in what everyone else is doing too. And so definitely looking for people who are curious in terms of how they're thinking about the space that we're in, right? And as you said, the space that we're in is flexible. It's like if you have a passion for B2B, you know, we could be a good fit for you. If you have a passion for children's products and baby and, you know, maternity and family, we could be a good fit for you. If you have a passion for marketplace models, you know, and kind of connecting distributed networks and long tails, we could be a good fit for you. If you have a curiosity and a passion for recommendation, we could be a good fit. So that curiosity piece for us is really important in terms of hiring.
Okay.
And then I would say also because we are a startup, it's like I look for tenacity. You know, there's a lot of bumps in the road. You get a lot of no's, and that's across every type of role that we have. And so I'm always looking for people who, you know, have faced some form of diversity in their past, professionally, personally, whatever it is, and have gotten back up, right? You know, and kind of getting beaten down. So
You've
that's important as
down,
well.
Yeah. And back up. Yeah.
It's like the song.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, but as far as like specific roles, are you looking for technology people, product managers, sales?
So looking for tech people, looking for folks
what
in marketing.
What tech stack do you use?
Python. Okay.
Yeah.
Looking for folks in marketing. But really like what we found is, you know, even though we do have specific roles that are open, is finding someone who is curious, who's tenacious, who's smart, and almost creating a role to get them in the organization.
I agree.
Is
when you
is
find
better.
The right person,
Yeah, like, you just, when you find the right person, you want to hold on.
It's like marriage, you know?
Yeah, it's like you want to hold on, you want to treat them right, and you right. Want to make sure that it's like, we're a place that, you know, smart, fun, tenacious, curious people want to come work.
Right, right. Awesome. Well, this is wonderful. I mean, you know, I thought I'm going to be talking to a toy store, but I'm talking to a actually somebody that's going to really change the way retail is working. I mean, I love your vision.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's much more than just the toy business.
Yeah, like a lot's changing. It's why I'm excited to be here at shop.org. And so it'll be interesting to see in the next couple of years. I think you're going to see a lot in the local space and in the small business space, especially for retail. That's going to change really quickly. A lot of interesting new models are going to come out, not just on the B2B side, but, you know, in terms of solving the last mile problem, same day delivery, you know, helping even retailers better manage who's in their store, who their customers are, like all of that data. So yeah, I think it's a great time to be doing what we're doing.
All right. Best of luck.
Thank you. Appreciate that.